All right, welcome to the next talk in the Ware College. Frank has finished talking about all the different possible World War IIs we could have had, and he's going to talk about getting published as a science fiction author. And he is a published science fiction author as well as a nonfiction author. Yes, and he's also going to have some other interesting fiction coming out, hopefully. I don't know how much you can touch upon that, but we're all anxious to hear.
We'll keep this with science fiction, probably, unless we run out of things to talk about.
Okay, but we're very, very fortunate to have Frank as our special guest this year again at CelestiCon, and I want to welcome him and thank him for helping all of us learn how to become well-paid, maybe even rich, authors.
Well, thank you, Ben. By any chance, as you know, I've been writing fiction seriously for a bit over 10 years, and finally got published about 2 years ago in a series of e-books done by Untreed Reads, and then my debut print novel came out last January. It's called How Dark the World Becomes. It's from Bain Books. My second print science fiction novel is coming out this coming January. It's called The Forever Engine, also from Bain Books. And we'll see what comes after that. I'm talking with them about a bunch of projects, some of them science fiction, some historical fiction. And we'll see what comes next, but something's coming next.
Frank, on the e-books, what were those 2 years ago? What were the subjects?
The e-books are a series of books called Space 1889 and Beyond. And they're a series of novels and novellas, continuously linked series with the same general group of characters, two in particular that it follows through, by a variety of different authors. They're all set in my Space 1889 universe, which some of you know about. It's a steampunk universe. It was an old game universe, and now it's a fiction universe. And in fact, the novel The Forever Engine, coming out in January from Bain Books, is also set in the Space 1889 universe.
All right.
If you like, I will read you the first chapter of that at the end of this talk. I'm going to do a reading now from How Dark the World Becomes, the novel that came out in January. I'll just do the opening chapter and then a couple little paragraphs after that that flesh out a little bit, okay? Okay, this is How Dark the World Becomes. It's set about 100 years in the future, about 30 years in the future, we're contacted by a starfaring civilization of five intelligent races. They don't conquer us, they invite us to join. However, because of their intellectual property covenants, we are now permanently stuck as the lowest technology members of this thing. And so we end up with not the best jobs and place in this particular galaxy. So here we go, chapter one. Eric was something else. An iridescent-skinned lizard, a bit over 2 meters tall, wearing bell-bottoms, a tie-dyed t-shirt, and rose-tinted granny glasses. Pretty odd get-up for a human these days, let alone a Faroki. But Kako Erikatlak, Airy to his pals, was deep into that whole retro Haight-Ashbury scene. I figured that was how he romanticized mainlining Laugh. Well, that was his business. His shiny, hairless head looked small on that long body, and if you weren't used to looking at Faroki, there were things just wrong with it. The ears, big as your hands, leaf-like, delicate, and constantly moving. The narrow, slitted eyes, broad, flat nose, and the big brow ridges that made his forehead look smaller than it was made him look stupid, which he was not. He had me listening to his latest classical music acquisition. I could have told him Yanni being dead a little over a century don't make his stuff classical. But when your best customer wants to impress you with how hip he is to Terra Culture, you don't spit in his eye. You sit there and you listen to the overproduced soulless crap as if it meant something. The sound and the pattern of the walls changed around us in time with the music. The smart surface keyed into the audio data stream. And Airy had his system rigged to look like a back-projected psychedelic light show. Only thing missing was a lava lamp. Finally, it was over. And Ares took a slow, gurgling pull on his water pipe, ears quivering, smiling in dreamy pleasure. He held the mouthpiece in his long, bony lizard fingers, too long for the number of joints, so they looked awkward and graceful at the same time, like spider legs. Beautiful, Sasha. You agree? A remarkable piece of music, I answered honestly, feeling no need to share the precise remark I had in mind. Do you know why I find your music, human music, so fascinating? Because it is a window to your souls, and your souls are amazing. We found you, what, less than 70 standard years ago, and already human composers, architects, designers are everywhere. Your music and visual arts have thrown the aesthetic sensibility of the Koto Haas into turmoil. But this other side of you, this delicious, savage darkness, your soldiers are the most feared in the Koto Haas, second only perhaps to the Zashan. And humans are taking over organized crime everywhere. You are such brilliant criminals. Well, now you're making me blush, I said. I shifted my weight and put my left arm up on the back of the couch, and my jacket fell open a little to show the chrome-plated automatic in the shoulder holster. I hardly ever wear the damn thing, but Eric gets a kick out of it, and what the hell? A little theater never hurts. So if we're so smart, how come you guys own everything? He smiled and tilted his head to the side a bit, the equivalent of a shrug. Give yourselves time, Sasha. Oh, that's good advice, Masahari, I drawled. Meantime, we just keep chopping cotton. He smiled again, knowing enough human history to appreciate the reference. Like I said, very into terra cultura. He took another slow pull on the pipe and studied me, ears twitching playfully. Eri likes to play the fool, but he has to stretch his acting chops to do it. Speaking of brilliant criminals, he said, how is Mr. Markov these days? Still a homicidal sociopath. How's your boss? He laughed. That creepy, barking honk of a lizard laugh, ears fluttering like butterfly wings. Still very far away, and not very interested in me. The best sort of boss. Amen to that, brother, I said. I didn't know a lot about Eri's organization, except he liked to refer to it as his brotherhood. I figured he picked that up from Terra Cultura as well, even though no human criminal I knew of had used that term for maybe a century. Speaking of business, I said, you got something for me. He rose, unfolding like a pocket stiletto, and glided to a small table, rattan and wood, simple but elegant. Looked like Sung Dynasty to me. Reproduction, of course, but a nice one. I used to be a second story guy, and you can't make money at that without an appraiser's eye. He opened a black lacquered box on top of the table, took out a neat stack of Kato Flexi chips bundled together with plastic, and tossed it lightly across the room to me. I caught it with my left hand and put it in my jacket pocket without counting. I trusted Eri, and besides, it was short, I knew where he lived. Tell me, he said, his eyes more serious, how confident are you and Mr. Markov in the continued reliability of your supply? If there's a problem, I don't know about it. Hell, Kolya wants me to lean on you to up your volume. Interesting, Eri said thoughtfully, his ears open but folded slightly back, alert but cautious. Mr. Markov tells you to encourage me to increase my purchases, but you choose not to. Why? He walked back and settled into his foreman chair, waiting patiently for an answer while it readjusted to his shape. It was a good question. I just wasn't sure he was going to like the answer. The thing Eri and Kolya Markov have in common is both of them are dangerous enough to get them killed, but that's about the extent of the similarity. The big difference, aside from the whole lizard thing, is I figure the worst move I can make with Kolya is to tell him the unvarnished truth. The worst move I can make with Eri is to bullshit him. Well, I see it like this. We get pretty good cover from your people up the food chain, but sooner or later enough high-end leatherheads are going to get themselves dead on laugh. There's going to be serious heat, more serious than you're going to want to handle. On that day, as we like to say, the shit hits the fan, and I figure all this shit is likely to hit our fan. You're going to walk away clean, Eri, and just find yourself another hobby, or we're going to be up to our ears in Coco Jack provosts. I took a chance calling him and the other Verokis leatherheads, and his ears had folded tightly back against his head when I did, but he relaxed into a smile by the end of my little speech. If you insult someone, they may not love you for it, but they'll give you points for honesty. That's kind of a cross-cultural truism. Did you share this insight with Mr. Markov? Sure, for what it's worth. Kolya fought on Nishtaka, so he says he's not afraid of the Cobra Jack. Markov fought in the Nishtaka campaign? Eri asked, his ears fanning wide again. Yeah, so what? Yesterday's news. It's not like he was the only guy there. He shook his head and drew on the pipe, his ears settling back. Sasha, Sasha, he said, taking the pipe from his mouth and waving it at me like a scolding finger. You are too hard on your friends. Veterans of Nishtaka speak with admiration of the two human rogue brigades they fought there. Well, nobody ever said Koya didn't have steel teeth, I answered, and Airy nodded his agreement. So what do you plan to do, my friend? He asked, and the pipe went back into his mouth, eyes narrow and unreadable, ears motionless. Of course, he hadn't said I was wrong. One of the things I like about Airy is he doesn't waste your time denying the obvious. Don't know yet, I answered truthfully. He leaned his head back and studied me for a moment in unguarded curiosity. Then why share this with me? I knew it would entertain you. For a second he said nothing, and then he broke into laughter. That same creepy, honking laughter. It was a good question, though. What was I going to do? I thought about it as the teardrop-shaped auto cab hissed out from the riverside traffic trench and insinuated itself into the tail-end tatters of the evening commute. Clear top, I commanded. The roof went transparent, and I leaned back, taking in the view up the canyon walls, stars twinkling in the narrow ribbon of black sky way up at the top, kilometers overhead, like a diamond necklace hopelessly beyond reach. Glowing traffic ramps snaked up the sides of the canyon, linking apartment blocks and crowded market clusters, hanging from the canyon walls like glass and concrete moss. The Leatherheads had a name for the city, something that translated as Capital of Peace Catan, about as creative a name as they ever thought of. Humans had come up with their own name, and now that's what everyone called it, even the Leatherheads. Crack City. Climb all the way up to the top of the crack. Climb all the way up and walk on the surface of Peace Catan, and you die in maybe a minute. Your lungs failing in near vacuum, the yellow-orange light of prime burning your skin off. But way down here, down at the bottom of the crack, people can live. All kinds of people. Leatherheads like Airy, humans like me. At least until the ship hits the fan. So, that's the first chapter. One of the things, I will tell you a little bit about how that book came to be published, because I think it's important. I don't have an agent. I submitted it over the transom, which there's like hardly any publishers anymore that accept submissions over the transom. Over transom means you submit it to them without an agent. You follow their submission guidelines. If they have submission guidelines, most publishers now will not accept unagented submissions, but my publisher, Bain Books, actually encourages them. They get about 1,000 unagented submissions a year, of which they publish maybe one. Most of the stuff they publish is existing authors, but they look to cultivate new authors. And they understand that usually means encouraging my agent. And so they have a lot of people whose thankless job is to plow through endless stacks of novel-length manuscripts, read them, and reject them. That's mostly their job, you know. So I submitted it to Bain. It sat there for about a year and a half, and then they tried to read it, and the electronic file was corrupted, and so I had to resubmit it. They sent me a thing and said, but we can't open it, it's, you know, corrupted. So I resubmitted it and sat there for about another year and a half, and I was about to pull it when one day I just got an email from the publisher at Bain Books that said, well, one of my editors said I should look at this, and I really like it. I love the character. We want to publish it. What do you, you know, are you still interested, or do you want to make an offer? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. And so that's how this book came about. And the reason I tell you all that is because the reason this book is published today is because of the voice of Sasha. That Sasha, the main character who narrates this, has a, I think you will understand that he has an extremely a unique and a voice that really stands out and grabs you. Right now, there's more books being published than ever in history, and that includes ebooks. I mean, there is just a tidal wave of ebooks out there. It has never been easier in history to get your book in front of some people. Now, how many of them actually buy it is different. You know, how many you can get to buy it is different, but you can certainly make it available. And a lot of people are taking advantage of that. If you're interested in writing, the first thing you have to think about is not being like the people who are already published. I mean, that's the worst trap I think you can fall into. They'll look at what's published and say, yeah, if I'm like that, then I can get published. No, because that's already published. What publishers are really looking for, what editors are looking for, is a new voice, a new sound, something unique, something that people haven't heard before. And you have to really concentrate on not trying to be like people who've already... I mean, that normally you'd look at people who succeed and you'd be like them, and you can't do that in writing. And you've got to be something different because they've already got that. You know, they don't want more of that, they've got that. And if they want more of that, that guy will be happy to write it for them and is probably busy doing exactly that right now. Okay? Everybody loves series. So if you like, for example, the Otter Harrington series, that's okay. There's plenty of people writing Otter Harrington books right now. And if the original author can't write enough, they hire us other authors to write books in the series too, so you can get even more. So what you really need to do is think about finding your own unique author's voice. I think that's maybe the most important thing, is not trying to follow in the tracks other people have made. Somebody asked me in an interview in Science Fiction Signal magazine not too long ago. It was an interesting question. Do I think writing can be taught? Do I think writing can be learned? And my answer is that I think most of it can. You know, I think the craft of writing can be learned. Like any craft, you can learn and study. I don't think inspiration can be taught. I don't think genius can be taught. I don't think you can be taught to be Tolstoy or Joseph Conrad. I don't think there's any course that can make you those things. But short of being a genius, short of being a master author, there is a lot. There are positions that are worth aspiring to. You know, you can be taught to be a journeyman writer who writes consistently satisfying stories about characters people feel involved in, and that tell them things. You give them insights about life, and in the process entertain them. And I think that's something worth aspiring to, and I think that's absolutely possible. I was asked at that time, how do you learn to do that? And here is how I learn. I don't know how you learn to, if this will work for you. And I don't think one size fits everyone, but here's my summary of how I learned to write. And I would say the first thing is read a lot. Read a lot. Read good authors. Read authors who write well. But don't do it as homework. Find good authors who you really enjoy reading, who you wish you could write that way. And not all of them, you know, there's some great authors that you're just not going to like to read. Don't worry, don't read them. But you can find good authors who write really well, who you really enjoy reading, and you should read those. And read a lot. Read them as much as you can. Because reading really good writing is the first, I think, essential step to learning how to write. The second step is to write. Just write and write and write. Even if it's crap, don't worry about it. Because the way we learn to write is to write. There are people I have heard about who sit down their first time out and write beautiful, timeless prose that turns into best-selling novels, right? Then you're like 17-year-old people who sell, right? Not only best-selling novels, but ones that are highly praised by critics. Those people are witches, okay? they're not like the rest of us. That's not that is not you. It's not me. And and get used to it. You know that the path to good writing is to write. The path to writing well, I believe, is first to write badly, and then fix it. And do that over and repeat as needed until eventually you write well. But you can't get to the point where you write well unless you make all those mistakes. And if you're afraid of making those mistakes and afraid of exposing yourself in your incompetence, you're not going to get where you need to go. You just can't be afraid of that. You just got to boldly go out there and fuck up, and then have people tell you how fucked up it is, and accept that, you know, kind of own that and fix it, and then keep doing that. So I think that aspect of writing is absolutely essential. Of writing badly as a first step towards writing well. I would say next, read books about writing. There are some excellent books about writing. I don't consider them how-to manuals. I don't consider them secret keys to success. But the process of your writing, as you're making all these mistakes and as you're trying to process what you've done wrong and how to do it right, some of these, you'll find books on writing that will really help focus your mind and make those lessons easier. You still got to do the work of writing badly and fixing it, but some of those books will help you see how to do it a little quicker and more clearly and can kind of focus your mind. I don't think, I could recommend some books that work for me, but I would say that everybody's needs as authors, as writers, are different, and you're going to find different, and your styles are different, and they ought to be. So you need to find books about writing that work for you, that kind of that talk to you. And I know people have suggested some books to write to me that I've read them, and they just didn't do anything for me at all. They weren't scratching itches that I had that I needed. They weren't saying things where I needed answers. There were other books that I love that I've directed to people, and they said, eh, you know. Very quickly, I'll give you a couple books that I found very useful. I really, really like Donald Moss's book, Writing the Breakout Novel. I really like James Scott Bell's book. It's from Writers. I think both these are from Writers Digest publishers, who has a lot of good books about writing. I like James Scott Bell's book, Plot and I forgot the name, but it's I think it's Plot and Structure. Really, really good book on that. About as good a book on that subject as I think I've ever seen. I like, there's a guy named Tam Mossman who has a book called 7 Strategies in Every Bestseller, which I really like as well. I mean, it's kind of a wacky book in a lot of ways, but I really like it. It's something to me very interesting is that Tam Mossman was an agent and an editor for a long time. Donald Moss is an agent. They are not great towering authors. They are guys who, I really like books by editors and agents because those are people that instead of on their own struggling with their own talent and how to make it work, they're people who just spent their life reading stacks and stacks and stacks of manuscripts, some of which were terrible and some of which were brilliant and a lot of stuff which is in between. And after a while, those big numbers of reading, they start seeing patterns. Which an individual author won't see, but those editors and agents will see patterns in writing and say, you know, all these things really were successful and all these things really bombed, and there's some things that are in common with all these things that succeeded. And they can kind of start directing you to those things, and I find that really useful. So I like, those three books are probably the three books I keep going back to most often. But that's because I'm really interested in plot and structure and kind of some of the mechanics of what makes things readable and appeal to people. And that may not be what you need. You know, it may be what you're lacking. But I would say that would be my third thing. Read books about writing because they can speed your process. They can help you along the way. They can light a little bit of the dark. My fourth thing is write more. Write some more. Just keep writing. Write as much as you can. And write, if you don't feel like writing a novel, write a short story. If you don't feel like that, write essays, write something. But just keep writing. And those are the four essential steps. I also have found writing groups and online critique groups very useful. And I encourage them. I can't say that they'll help everybody. They really, really helped me in a surprising way. Not so much for the criticism I received of my writing, but of the criticisms I gave other people of their writing. I found more helpful to my writing in the long run. Why? Because there's rules and rules and rules, and you're going to find a million rules, but all those rules can be violated if there's a good reason for doing it. And of course, that also means that to a certain extent, you know that some of those rules don't really apply to you, right? Don't put a lot of backstory at the beginning of your story. But people really will enjoy this, and they really need to know this to really appreciate all the nuances of the story. So I have to tell them all this stuff. And you can convince yourself of that, but after you've spent 20 sessions telling 20 different authors that the problem with their story is it's boring because it's loaded up with backstory at the front, you finally realize, you know, maybe I'm not immune to this rule either. Okay? It is a way to kind of experience that thing that I identify in agents and editors, seeing a large volume of stuff, and seeing a large volume of stuff with the same mistake over and over again is so much more persuasive and convincing, and making you think about what's wrong with the writing. That's what's really important, because you look at all these different writers, and you've got to think about what works and what doesn't work in it, and why, and explain it. And that's a terrifically useful, I think, analytic exercise in terms of structuring your own thinking about what works and doesn't in your own life. Yes?
You have to be dumb or dumb. What's a backstory?
Backstory is like the story starts with a boy and a girl on a hill. The girl actually is the granddaughter of the empress of Hula Hula Land, who was kidnapped by this guy over here, you know, who took her to this other land, and, you know, she had a baby by this, but that baby was killed. But then over here, meanwhile, her uncle, that's backstory, okay? Meanwhile, the boy and the girl are still on the hill waiting for you to get done so they can talk to each other. Yes?
Okay. Frank's story right there, the one he just read, okay? The backstory is the events leading up to humans being incorporated into the alien empire.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened the 7 years since they've been incorporated in the alien empire. He tells us that in the back cover, but when he starts out the story, it starts out with Sasha and his alien pal. Mm-hmm. And they don't talk about anything that's happened in the past, they talk about it in dialogue.
Find out in dialogue
that the humans are the mean, nasty guys in this alien empire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the raw backstory was a paragraph.
Yeah, yes. They touch on a little bit of backstory, but you try to incorporate as much as possible into an essential part of the conversation as to why Aerie would want to talk about this. There's a type of insertion of backstory that is called As You Know Bob dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
This is the standing joke in writing communities, As You Know Bob dialogue. Now, As You Know Bob dialogue is when two guys are standing on the bridge of the starship and say, As you know, Bob, the planet of Alpha Centauri over here has had a war with us for 20 years. Well, yes, I know, George. And as you know, well, it's two people talking to each other about things that they probably already know, but just for the purpose of us overhearing their conversation. That is not considered great writing. As you know, Bob, dialogue is not.
On the other hand, you better watch your ass because so and so is looking for it. It is better dialogue.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So, yes.
I'm wondering if the face-to-face writing critique groups, kind of like the Inklings, is that on the decline, and is it just better to find a forum online to submit and have people critique, and then you.
It depends on whether or not you can find a critique group. I have right now where I live in Champaign, Illinois. I'm in three writers groups. They're all face-to-face critique groups.
Okay, you work like we meet at a cafe and just.
One of them meets in the upstairs meeting room of a vegetarian restaurant. One of them I organized, and it's part of an adult education group called the OSHA Lifelong Learning Institute. We meet every week as part of that. And when there are certain sessions going on that we can't meet, we meet over the library. But we probably have about a dozen people that show up every meeting. You know, 12 to 14 people that usually show up at each of those two.
Uh-huh.
And then I'm in a third one that only meets once a month, and it's about a half dozen people at each meeting. But the other two meet every week. About a dozen people, and it's reading and critiquing all the time.
say, like you'll read a sample chapter.
Yeah, usually a sample chapter. If one of the groups read a sample chapter, they only kind of limit it to a couple pages, so maybe a half a chapter.
Thank you.
And I find those really useful. But I find online stuff as well. Sometimes online you can be, you don't have to worry about the as much about the dynamics. You can't see the pain in their face. You should always be considerate in your critiquing. You're not critiquing somebody, you're critiquing their work. Mm-hmm. And it's not about them, it's about their work. But nevertheless, writers put a lot in their work, so you cannot, that's a fiction we maintain, that it's just about the work, it's not about them, because when you write something, there's part of you in it. So you always need to be as considerate as you can possibly be. But you're not. But by the same token, remember that you're not doing anybody a favor by not telling them that something's wrong with their story, because their purpose ought not to be to get gratification. It ought to be to get published. And the way you help them to get published is tell them what's wrong so they can fix it.
Okay.
Yeah. So. Let me talk a little bit about what I see as the elements of writing. I mean, this isn't rocket science, but I mean, in general, the elements of a story that people always talk about are plot, character, setting, and theme. Plot, character, setting, and theme. And it used to be, I mean, it still is to an extent, but it used to be you could kind of divide genres up by the emphasis they had on those. Mysteries are, classical mysteries are like almost all plot. You know, it's just this puzzle that you want to unravel. And characters are kind of secondary to that. And setting is, it's a British castle somewhere, or a British pub or whatever. A drawing room, the drawing room mysteries, they're all kind of alike. They don't rely on setting so much as being an important element of the story. You get to science fiction and fantasy. Setting is extraordinarily important, isn't it? I mean, some stories you think are almost all about setting. It's just about showing you the world, and the plot and the characters are just kind of mechanisms for you to get to the place. Yes?
Actually, in some situations, the world setting is a character.
I suppose so, yeah. But I think in general, the classic science fiction, the emphasis has been mostly on the setting. Not so much as a character, but as important of itself. The Asimov's Foundation trilogy is about telling you this about how this universe works and what's happening in it. But the plot is not nearly as important to me as the setting. It's very interesting. The Dune books, certainly Dune is a fascinating plot, but the big thing is it's amazingly intricate, well-detailed world, and I think that's true. One of the reasons people go to a lot of science fiction and fantasy is to find that, is to experience that world.
Mm-hmm.
Tolkien's world is not a very complicated plot, is it?
No.
And in a lot of ways, characters I don't think are very interesting, but the world is really interesting. The world's about what it's about. When we talk about literary fiction, whatever you think that is, I mean, theme is terrifically important, and character is terrifically important. And to hear some critics of literary fiction as opposed to other fiction tell it, plot for them really is a four-letter word, which, interestingly enough, it actually is a four-letter word. But I mean, the plot is like, in some parts of the literary writing community, it's just, plot's that icky stuff. You got to have a little of, but the less the better. I think all that's changing. That more and more people are talking about a non-genre called crossover fiction. Who's heard the term crossover fiction?
It's not a crossover SUV.
What is crossover fiction? Crossover fiction is genre fiction written to literary standards. That's kind of what we used to call most fiction back in like the 1920s, But that's it's back when when best-selling fiction was literary in nature, when Hemingway and those guys dominated, if writers of that caliber dominated popular fiction, didn't ever quite dominate it to the much extent as we remember. Who knows who the best-selling author in the 1920s was in the United States?
which do you well? Oh, in the United States?
In the United States, 1920s. Best-selling author.
Not science fiction author.
Best-selling author overall.
The guy that did Doc Savage, was that 1920s?
Nope. That's E. Doc Smith.
E. Doc Smith?
Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Oh, okay.
Edgar Rice Burroughs was the best-selling author in the United States in the 1920s. So, and I don't know that anybody would exactly call him literary, but...
that's where you confused us.
Yeah. But more and more people are talking about crossover fiction. Crossover fiction is genre fiction written to literary standards. It's increasingly, it's literary authors who've decided to branch out and write some genre pieces. And what it shows is an understanding in the literary community, in the literary writing community, the plot really is important. You know, people want a story, and plot is kind of essential to telling that an interesting story. But it's also an understanding in the science fiction community and the mystery community that character is important, that theme is important, that it's not just plot and setting. That your character is not just some wooden guy who carries your plot forward like it's a flag on the end of a banner to the end of your book, and that the story ultimately is about your character, not about this intricate little plot you come up with. So I see our understanding of the relative importance of those things is becoming much more balanced across writing these days, and an understanding that everybody needs to kind of cultivate all of those, that you can't ignore any of those things. You can't ignore any of those things. I will talk now a little bit about, and this will be kind of the last, let me see how we're doing on time here.
Buckets of time, you got 20 minutes.
I got 20 minutes, okay. I want to talk a bit about the secrets, but these are my personal, is some kind of personal things I found in terms of writing that I have to always keep in mind, and I think are very important to succeeding for me as a writer. And succeeding, I will give you my definition of succeeding as a writer. I did a novella called A Prince of Mars. That's one of the ebooks I did for Untrigued Reads. I sent it to a friend of mine to read, and she was she said she's got a bunch of graduate students that are doing stuff, and she had stuff she had to grade. She had some theses proposals she had to look at, and she just opened her email and she saw that I'd sent it to her. And she just opened it up to make sure it had sent it correctly, that it hadn't been corrupted. And she said, and then I just sat down and read it and did not get up even to get a glass of water until I finished it. That's the highest compliment I've ever had as an author, okay? The best thing you can tell an author is not, this is really good. It's, I couldn't stop reading it once I started. And if that doesn't happen by accident, you have to work at that. You have to set your mind that you're going to make, and you almost have to do it ruthlessly in my mind. You have to, every page, think about what you can do to make it so the reader has to read the next page. It doesn't just happen magically. It's not just the tinkling joy of listening to your voice. It's something you really do deliberately and methodically, and eventually maybe by second nature without having to think about it so much. But at first you have to think about it. You really have to think about making sure everybody wants to turn the page and read that next page.
And you also, and the next page, and pacing. Pacing.
Right, we're getting to that, okay? Or you can have your own talk.
No. I mean, you raise the subject. I explain.
The essential element of this is, it's not a term I came up with, but it's a perfect term. It's called the reader's trance. When somebody's reading, you want them to go into a trance where they're no longer aware they're reading. That they just enter into the world completely, and they don't want to come out of that world. And so what do you do to develop that reader's trance and not break it? Here are the things that in general I believe are important to that. The first thing is, at the beginning of a story, show us the character. Stories are about characters. They're not about
this the setting. They're not about theme. They're not about, you know, I think modern stories, at least, are about characters. And you've got to show people a character right away. And this sounds demeaning. It is not meant to be demeaning of readers, but readers are like newly hatched geese. They will imprint on the first character they see. So you, in my opinion, it's a terrible mistake not to make the first character your readers see or hear not be the most important character in the novel. I think it's possible. I've seen some really good writers do it the other way, but you're making a lot of extra work for yourself. And if you are, and if you guys are, you know, if to the extent that you guys are starting interested in reading, I think that you need to make it as easy on yourself as possible. And so the first thing is you've got to show them that character, your first character, really soon, so they can imprint while they're still willing to imprint. And then you got to, and then you got to help them imprint. But show us that character first, right off the bat. Second thing is, and you probably see this coming, don't give us a history lecture or a weather report. You know, I don't care if it was raining on the planet Mongo. I don't care who was the Emperor Hutentut the 29th and why he was overthrown. I don't care. I care about people, the people in your story, the people right there in your face. That's what I care about. Third, tell us the threat and the payoff as soon as you can. The threat the character faces if they fail, the payoff if they win. I want to know that. And you don't need to, or you can at least hint it. But we got to have some hint right off the bat that there's something looming over the character. You have some hint of the central conflict of the novel pretty quick, and some suggestion that if the character doesn't succeed, horrible things can happen, and if the character fails, well, so maybe some pretty good things can happen. And the more of that we get, the sooner, I think, the better. Here's a really good piece of advice that I got from James Scott Bell. I went to a workshop that James Scott Bell put on, and this is the single best sentence about writing I've ever heard anybody say. Write this down, put it on your wall. Tell simple stories about unforgettable characters. Tell simple stories about, and if you do that, you will succeed. But the key to that is unforgettable characters. How do you make your characters unforgettable? And that's just something you have to work on all the time. But remember, they can't be vanilla. They've got to be unique. They've got to have a unique... Remember what I said, that Sasha's unique voice sold that novel? That's why. Sasha becomes, I think, he was certainly designed by me to be an absolutely unforgettable character with an absolutely unique voice. Fifth thing, don't justify something you've written based upon it being done by some other best-selling authors. I run into this a lot when people, you know, do stuff that's not working, and I say, you know, I'm in a critique group, but I'll say, well, you know, this really doesn't work for this, this, and this reason. And they'll say, yes, but there's lots of best-selling authors that do that. Yeah, but that's not why they're best-selling authors. They're best-selling authors despite that. They do some brilliant other stuff that lets them be best-selling authors. This isn't it. And if you make your story a string of the worst habits of best-selling authors, you're not going to do well. You know, you need to look at a best-selling author and see why they're succeeding. And some of these other things that best-selling... I mean, because no author's perfect. Every author does things that are bad. Don't ever use the fact that somebody who has succeeded has done this, use that as an excuse for why you're doing it, because that's not a very good excuse. You got to do it for reasons that you've got to really understand. You got to be doing stuff for a reason. Six, I've said this before, but this is an essential element. Find your own unique voice. Find your own unique voice. Nobody wants another one. People may say they do, but they don't. I mean, there's already every voice that's out there is already there. If they like it, they've got it, and they can get more. You've got to find your own unique voices and all. You've got to find a way to stand out. A friend of mine in the game industry once said, nobody ever got rich selling turkeys. They got rich selling butterball turkeys. You've got to find a way to be a butterball turkey, not just a turkey. And seventh, there's got to be tension and conflict on every page of your story.
every single page. If you've got a scene where, if you were to have a synopsis of a theme that says, in this scene, so-and-so finds out X, that's not a scene. A scene has got to have conflict. A scene has got to... Here's the best description of a scene, of the DNA of a scene I ever read. This really changed a lot of my thinking about how to write. Regardless of what happens in a scene, you can diagram a scene this way. Number one, the character has a goal. Okay? Your character has a goal. They have something they want to accomplish. They're not sitting there hearing some information. There's something they want to accomplish in this scene. The second thing is, something is trying to keep them from accomplishing that in the scene. There is some obstacle to them accomplishing it that they have to try to overcome. That can be conflict with another character who doesn't want to tell them stuff. That can be conflict with someone who doesn't want them to do what they want to do if they find this out. But whatever it is, there's something in the scene that's an obstacle to them to carrying out that that thing. So the next thing is they try to overcome that, and then their attempt to overcome that is the meat of the scene, trying to overcome that resistance. And here's the most important thing, the fourth element. They fail. Every scene ends with some element of failure, because when you succeed, the story's over. So you may not. So it may be you don't get the information you need. It may be that in getting the information you need, you alienate someone you need to help you, or you alienate someone that the character cares about and doesn't want to alienate and loses that way. It may be that you find out what you need to do, but when you find that out, you discover that you don't really need to know that. You need to know something else. Or what you really discover is the problem's bigger than you thought it was. And it's not, you know, there's all sorts of different ways to skin that. But every scene ends to a certain extent in failure. And that could be less than complete success. But when you think of scenes that way, there's always conflict. There's always tension going through every page. And that's the sort of thing that makes it tough to put a book down, doesn't it?
So that's my quick recipe of at least how I go about it. At least how I go about it. I see we have 8 minutes left. So questions? Yes.
I actually tried to write some fiction once, and the problem I ran into, I'm interested in how you write your fiction.
Okay.
Because you're making up a story. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was difficult to, say, put it aside and then come back, because I had to remind myself where I was and pick up the train of what I was thinking to do the fictional story, as opposed to history, which I, you know, if I'm using so many reference books, you know, 2 weeks later, I can come back and pick up the thread of where I was, because I'm not writing my story. I'm using these pieces of information to continue explaining to the reader what happened. Yeah. And I put together a story out of these components. Whereas in the fictional story, it's like I have to go back and get myself up to speed where I was.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a very good idea to put fiction aside for a while and then come back to it, unless you're really, really going to put it aside for a long time. And you need to restart everything and really rethink it.
So how do you do it when you write a book that many pages?
I write every day.
Okay.
Every morning I get up, and I sit at the word processor, and I write. And the first thing I may do is I'll go back and read what I wrote the day before. And then I'll write. And I have a word count goal of about 1,500 words a day. And I don't always make it, but I usually make it, and sometimes I go longer. I don't write past noon unless haven't made my word goal, but I think I can if I keep writing, then I'll go. But usually otherwise I'll knock off at noon. I always like to knock off knowing what I'm going to start writing the next day. You know, so I always like to knock off so I know almost in the first sentence that I'm going to write the next day. Those are the way, but it's tough to walk away from and then come back and still be fresh. You need to have the momentum of the story. You need to cultivate the momentum of the story.
If you can't keep up your interest, the reader won't either.
Sure. Yeah.
And when you're dealing with science fiction, you're still writing that backstory. It may not end up in the book.
That's true.
But there's still a backstory that's either sitting up here or it's sitting on another document. So that history can be there.
Yeah.
You turn off the phone and turn off the emails and...
I don't go that far, but I mean, I like to get up and have my cup of morning coffee and get at least 350 to 400 words written before I have breakfast. I mean, I like to just... And that way I feel like, hey, I got a good chunk done already. I can have breakfast, I can, you know, kind of sit and think about it. But that's kind of my first goal, is get, you know, about 350, you know, get a couple, like a page and a half, 2 pages done. And then I feel like, okay, now I can have some breakfast and come back to this, and I got a momentum going, I can get through to my work count for the day.
Okay, and if you got a full-time job?
Then you get up at 3 a.m, right? Okay.
Or late at night, right, when you get home?
Well, I think it's better to get up early in the morning, but whatever works for you. I mean, some people write better at night. I write better in the morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
Also, some people, if they don't have a regular job, some writers will be writing several things at one time.
Everybody likes
to and they go from one to the other based on how they feel in the morning, because they need time to let things cogitate, and so they also keep up their writing, so they're always writing something.
Okay, everybody writes differently. Yeah. Yes?
Do you think it's good for aspiring authors to try to start with compilations of short stories, or just make their first submission a novel?
There's not much demand for short stories right now, although the e-revolution is increasing the demand. There's not as many venues for short stories as there used to be. There are more in science fiction than some of the other genres. So there's still some market for short stories.
What do you mean by venue?
A venue would be like a magazine. It used to be lots of magazines took short stories. It used to be Saturday Evening Post. Mm-hmm. Came out every week nationwide, and it was full of short stories. I mean, there used to be a ravenous demand for short stories in the United States, and so there were all these venues for publication. Television replaced that. Television is how we get our short stories now. You know, a half-hour episode on TV is a short story, and that's really knocked the demand for short stories down, because that kind of satisfies a lot of that demand. But there's still some demand for it. I find short stories, and this is, everybody writes differently, I find short stories incredibly difficult to write compared to a novel. You know, I think novels are, there's a lot of words, but I understand how it works. A short story is like writing, it's like making a little watch. You know, everything's got to work together perfectly, and short stories are hard.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you can write short stories, great, you know.
Yeah.
But I have a hard time. But like I say, everybody approaches it differently, everybody writes differently. I think the way most people break in right now is a novel.
Okay.
You know, because that's what most of the demand is for, is novels. There's very little demand in science, even in science fiction and fantasy, which has more than some areas, there's very little demand for short stories compared to novels. I mean, go to a bookstore and see how many anthologies you see on the shelf, mm-hmm. as opposed to novels.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Analog just changed its editor, so it has a new voice, and we don't know what that voice is yet.
Yeah. Yes. I was going to read another section, but I don't know if we really have time to do it, because Jack's going to be here.
3 minutes.
3 minutes. So
can you call that Mickey Mouse fast voice? There's a fine print on the end, you know, you cover it.
So when's the next one in this series going to come?
I don't know, because although I was the one on this series is tentatively titled "Come the Revolution," and that's the one I was working on until very recently. It may be that I will be doing some work in historical fiction, and historical fiction is obviously very close to science fiction, because both of them rely heavily on setting, the unique setting. People come to them in a lot of ways for the setting, although it's the story that keeps them there. So I may be doing some work in that. We'll see how things work out. But if not, if that doesn't work out, the next one, I have very mixed feelings about that. I mean, there's some historical fiction I really want to write, primarily about Persia in the time of Alexander's conquest. But the next one in this has 4 chapters done on it, and I've temporarily stopped, which is very bad. But okay, so if I get started on this again, I will do that. Otherwise, I will be going to the historical fiction and then eventually coming back. But so I can't tell you when the next one of this will be out. But the next book will be The Forever Engine, which is the steampunk book. And I will tell you, I will just give you a brief rundown of the setup of that. It's a unique steampunk book.
Okay.
It really is. It starts in August 2nd, 2018, in Wessex, England, which is, you know, so it starts in our near future in this world. It felt there's a catastrophic accident at a particle accelerator lab, And the fellow wakes up in a hospital in 1888 London, but it's a different sort of London. There are flying ironclads, and turns out they have colonies on Mars. And so a lot of it's, and there is a possibility in his mind, but the people, the thought was at Rustic's that there is a possibility that someone has changed the past, and there is now a wave front coming through time, which is wiping out everything, all the presents, and then changing them into this alternate world as it goes, and that if this isn't fixed, it will eventually destroy our world. That may be an explanation. Mm-hmm. Or there may be other explanations for what's going on, but anyway, I think it is a unique one is that it actually does sort of make an effort to rationalize a steampunk world scientifically with the same physical laws that we have. So I mean, at one point, some fellow by the name of Tesla is giving a lecture in London about what he calls the force-bearing ether, as opposed to the luminiferous ether, the light-bearing ether. And his description of the force-bearing ether, our hero realizes, is it sounds a lot like the Higgs field. which is, of course, which is the big new thing right now, the Higgs boson and all that sort of stuff. It's actually attempt to kind of link those two together and explain them.
Thank you,
Frank. Thank you, Frank.